I would like us to start, and first I would like to welcome everyone. I can see our audience is quite full. That means we are seriously interested in trying out some of the interventions, which I think is a debate that everyone is interested in. My name is Jerry Wapiri. I work with the Human Science Research Council. I'm going to welcome everyone, all the distinguished guests. Everyone else, I want to say all protocols observed in case I miss something. So I won't take much time because I know you're actually more interested in Jeff rather than listening to what I'm just about to say. But I think I want to take a moment and say who is Jeff and why is he bothered with evidence and stuff like that. Jeff is one of our research directors in a unit called Social Aspects of HIV, AIDS and Health in Human Science Research Council. He has a doctor in public health, a master's in public health, a list of diplomas in nursing and health management. He warned me that I should not list all these things, but I want to overlook part of his advice and say a few things. He's involved in a lot of community work, and he's a co-chair of SANARC, monitoring, research monitoring, technical, tax team. So he's very much involved with SANARC, and we all know what SANARC is, the South African National AIDS Council. So he is the best person to tell us about the HIV intervention. He's also an adjutant professor in the University of Limpopo. And I think much of his experience and his ability will come out as he goes through the presentation. So I do not want to preempt him. I want to welcome everyone. I want to welcome Cape Town office and Durban. I can see we've got quite a number of people. Let us listen, because often in life, when there is no evidence or data, everyone is an expert. And often discussions do not shed light, they produce more heat. So I hope with Jeff's presentation, we will be able to have healthy discussions that will shed more light on to the HIV prevention and the interventions that work. Welcome, Jeff.
Thank you, Jerry, for the kind introductions, and thanks for all of you for attending this presentation. I was surprised why so many people were interested in this topic. I guess many of you think that I'm going to present the magic bullet, or I'm going to tell you about a cure. I'm going to disappoint any of you who are thinking that I'm going to present a magic bullet or a cure. But what I promised is to provide you with evidence of HIV prevention interventions that work. This is what I will do today. In this presentation, in the next 35 minutes, I just want to give a presentation, and for about 25 minutes or so, we'll have a discussion on my presentation. I'll just take us through an introduction and take us to where we come from with regards to innovations in HIV prevention. I'll then share what evidence we have, you know, what is evidence and the levels of evidence in HIV prevention. I make a proposal on the levels of evidence that we can use in measuring whether an intervention works or not. And then I will share HIV prevention interventions that, according to me, work, and I classify this according to biomedical HIV prevention interventions, behavioral HIV prevention interventions, and structural HIV prevention interventions. Okay. And at the end of every section, I'll give a summary of HIV prevention interventions that I think work. So at the end of biomedical interventions, I'll give a summary, and the same with behavioral and structural interventions. And I'll draw up some conclusions at the end. In the next slide, where I do the introduction, I just want to say that at the outset, we've had remarkable advances in the molecular biology of HIV, and there has been major therapeutic discoveries in the past 28 years. I think many of you now know that from 1981, when the epidemic started, a lot of things happened. In the first place, we did not know the name of the virus that was causing a problem in 1981. But in 1984, there was a discovery of the HI virus. And later on, there was the development of drugs in the 1990s that were used for the treatment of HIV/AIDS. So from 1996, we know that in the US, there was the use of drugs, you know, for the treatment of AIDS disease. And these started as monotherapy, dual therapy, and now triple therapy. We later on found that it was possible to prevent the transmission of HIV from mother to child, you know, late in the 1990s. And we also know that we developed some tests to identify the HIV virus in the blood. And later on, we also developed the abilities to be able to test whether somebody has been infected with HIV/AIDS in the last 6 months or so. These are major discoveries. We also have learned a lot late in the 1990s that we can alter behaviors. There was an introduction of theory risk behavior change interventions, and these interventions, we were able to change behaviors of different target groups with regard. These are remarkable advances, and it's important to note that. Now, many interventions have been developed and implemented. Some were tested for evidence of efficacy or effectiveness, and some were not. It's important, you know, as we go forward with the HIV epidemic, to know which interventions work or not. Now, 28 years into the epidemic, in 2009, before we get into the third decade, we're not sure which interventions work. We have tried everything because the epidemic hit us very fast, and so many people were dying, and so many people were getting infected, and we tried anything and everything. We were really desperate. And this is the typical situation that you see in an epidemic where there's desperation. We tried anything, whether it was abstinence, be faithful, compromise, whether it was ARVs, whether it was anything that was coming in, even traditional medications, we tried them because we were desperate for something that works. Now, I'm saying today we need to identify and use best and good evidence interventions that work. And today, I'm going to spend most of the time talking about the evidence of those interventions. Now, many of you who are here are either policymakers. You want your policy to be based on best evidence. Some of you are implementers of programs. The funders have told you that if you ask for the money, you must show them the evidence. And as implementers, you only want to implement interventions that are known to work. Researchers also want to get the evidence so that they can provide the right evidence. Funders also say, if you want to get money, show me that this thing works. And members of the community also want a solution to HIV/AIDS. They want to know why in 29 years or 28 years we've not been able to come up with an answer about HIV/AIDS. So many of you are coming from different sectors. You all want HIV prevention interventions that work before you can commit your resources. This is fair and reasonable. I'm presenting to you evidence of HIV prevention interventions that work and also present their level of effectiveness or efficacy. But in the next slide here, I want to start by defining the concept of evidence. What is evidence? Now, evidence is defined as fact or testimony in support of a conclusion, a statement, or belief, and something serving as proof. So you would say you have evidence if it provides proof that something works. Now, in the law, for those of you who are in Pretoria, we're opposite the magistrate court, and the lawyers actually come up with big bags that contain evidence. And they use that evidence, and they also bring in witnesses to prove guilt beyond reasonable doubt. But this is the area of law. HIV/AIDS is in the ambit of social sciences and epidemiology. So social scientists, let's call them social epidemiologists and clinical epidemiologists, they use p-values to show level of significance. For example, the epidemiologist would say if the p-value is equal to or less than 0.05, that says we are 95% confident that the observed difference is not due to chance. When they say it in the other way, they would say that if the p-value is equal to or less than 0.05, it means there's a 5% chance that what you observe may be due to chance, luck or chance. Let's use that word. So evidence is important. We need to prove that something works, and we say there's evidence. Now in this next slide, I provide a pyramid that shows the level of evidence or the pyramid of evidence that is being used in the social sciences and in the clinical sciences. Now, there's something called Animal Farm. Some are more equal than others. We conduct research. Some are doing clinical research, others are doing qualitative research, and even in the clinical research, there are those that are using different kinds of methodologies. The people who are using systematic reviews and meta-analysis are top of the pyramid, because systematic reviews and meta-analysis are actually taking up its research on high-level research, which means you are looking at randomized controlled trials of a particular intervention that have been conducted all over the world, and then you compare and you see what the effect is of each of the interventions. So it is currently classified as the highest level of evidence that you can provide. And that is why when you have conducted randomized control trials, they will quickly run and do a systematic review to see if there is consistency in all the findings so that we can say whether there's evidence or not. But the randomized control trials, many of you know that are called the gold standard. They are the gold standard because if you conduct a randomized control trial, it's an experiment. You are comparing two groups. There is clear comparison where the people who are receiving the intervention are compared with another group that are receiving no intervention or are receiving a standard treatment. And therefore, at the end, you can follow them up and say whether those that received the intervention did better than those that did not receive the intervention. So randomized control trials, especially if there is double blinding, are great, and they are classified as a gold standard. You know, when we use motor cars, we can talk about the Rolls Royces and the Mercedes-Benz here. But as we go down, starting to talk about the cohort studies and case control studies are also fine because there's an element of either comparison between the cases and the controls, or there is a follow-up of a cohort, a group of people with the same characteristics that is being followed up over a period of time. They are experiments, but they are not as powerful as the randomized control trials. But as you go down, you know, for rare diseases, you do case series and case reports, and this is how we got to know about HIV/AIDS, because we did case studies and case series of people who were presenting with similar symptoms at another point in time. But way down the pyramid, we have ideas and editorials and expert opinions and things like that. They are way low. The opinions do not count as strong as systematic reviews and randomized control double-blind studies. Now, in this slide, I have adopted this slide from the Centers for Disease Control. The CDC conducted what is called the Prevention Research Synthesis. And this synthesis was looking at the behavioral, they were actually doing a compendium of evidence-based behavioral HIV prevention interventions. And these were interventions that were supported by the CDC in the US, and they were tested on different groups. Many of them were theory-based behavior change interventions among different target groups. It could be men who have sex with other men, among young people, among all other target groups. Now, they classify them, they use two levels of evidence. They either call them best evidence or promising evidence. But I thought I should adopt this and use four levels of evidence. And this is my own proposal here. That for me, if an intervention has got an effectiveness or efficacy in a randomized controlled trial of 80% or more, I would call it best evidence. But if it has got an effectiveness or efficacy in a randomized controlled trial of between 60 and 79%, I'll call that good evidence. And if it has got an effectiveness or efficacy of 30 to 59%, I'll call that promising evidence. And if it has got the effectiveness of or efficacy of between 0 and 29%, I will say no evidence or poor evidence. This is an important slide because I will refer back to this slide. Although I come from Bantu education, I try to use the outcome-based approach in grading. You know, you get a distinction if you get 80%, and you get a first-class pass if you get 79%. And these days, they say you still pass, you know, with 30 to 59%. We used to pass with 50% or above. So I'm using the outcome-based education, okay? I hope you understand that. In the next slide, I want to take each of these biomedical HIV prevention interventions one by one and talk about the evidence that is out there on each of these. And these are the biomedical HIV prevention interventions that I will refer to in the next 15 minutes or so. I'll talk about male circumcision. I'll talk about what you call HART, or the highly active antiretroviral therapy, or also called ARVs. I'll talk about PMTCT, prevention of mother-to-child transmission of HIV-AIDS. I'll talk about both male and female condoms and talk about the evidence around that. I'll talk about treatment of STIs, or sexually transmitted infections, microbicides and cervical barriers, and also talk about HIV vaccine. I have not included things like any other biomedical intervention where we don't have evidence at this point in time. Let me start with the first one, and I know many people wanted to know. I will repeat the information that you know about this. 3 randomized controlled trials were conducted on male circumcision in South Africa, Uganda, and Kenya. And these randomized controlled trials concluded that there is compelling evidence that male circumcision is 65% effective in reducing the risk of acquiring HIV in circumcised male. The evidence was ranging from 50 to 65%. And I think in the last publication that come out of this, we can get up to 65% effectiveness or efficacy of male circumcision. But this is the randomized controlled trial, and I said RCTs are the gold standard. But also about the RCTs, there was a Cochrane review. If you look at the bottom of the screen, you will see that I used the latest publication from the Cochrane database of systematic reviews, where Nandi Sispirit and colleagues at the Cochrane Center did a systematic review on male circumcision for prevention of heterosexual acquisition of HIV in men. Now, that Cochrane review assessed data from the trials in South Africa, Uganda, and Kenya between 2002 and 2006, and those 3 interventions enrolled 11,054 males. And the reviewer said that the research on the effectiveness of male circumcision for preventing HIV in heterosexual men is conclusive. Now, the reviewer concluded that no further trials are required to establish that HIV infection rates are reduced in heterosexual men for at least the first 2 years after circumcision. For those in the other centers in Cape Town and Durban, if you click on, you'll see that 65%, according to me, in my grading, is good evidence. And before I leave this slide, just to say that as far as I'm concerned, male circumcision provide us with good evidence on the basis of my grading and on the basis of the randomized controlled trials and the information that we have from the reviews. In the next slide, let's talk about the HART, the antiretrovirals. Now, the antiretroviral therapy, the antiretroviral drugs were developed from around 1993-94, and they were used for the first time in the U.S. in 1996. The randomized controlled trials on highly active antiretroviral drugs that were conducted earlier on reported that 60 to 80% reductions in new AIDS illnesses, hospitalizations, and deaths. Now, a meta-analysis, and you can look at the reference at the bottom there. which talks about declining morbidity and mortality among patients with advanced HIV infection. This was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1998. This meta-analysis of 54 antiretroviral clinical trials has demonstrated that, one, using one antiretroviral reduced progression to AIDS or death by 30% as compared to a placebo. And two, including two antiretrovirals reduced progression to AIDS or death by 40% against one antiretroviral. And three, using three antiretrovirals reduced progression to AIDS or death by 40% against two antiretrovirals. Now, if we look up there, we can see that the reduction in AIDS illnesses due to the use of highly active antiretrovirals reduced illnesses, hospitalizations by 60 to 80%. Using my grade, they obtain what we call good evidence. And I say it's good to best evidence because 80% is the start of what I call best evidence. But we now know that antiretrovirals have been used extensively on the basis of this evidence that we have. It's not something new. In the next slide, I want to concentrate on the prevention of mother-to-child transmission of HIV. And I'm using a slide that was talking about antiretrovirals and perinatal transmission in Africa from 1995 to 2006. Now, this slide has got interesting bars because we come a long way with the prevention of mother-to-child transmission of HIV/AIDS. And it was comparing a situation where there was no provision of antiretrovirals to pregnant mothers before they gave birth to children if they were HIV positive. And it shows that the transmission of HIV/AIDS was higher than 20%. In fact, it was anything between 20 and 35% if there was no provision of any drug. But if there was a single cost of ridovidine, then the transmission of HIV was reduced to just over 10%. And the single dose of nevirapine also reduced the transmission of HIV to just over 10%. Now, there was an introduction of dual therapy at some point, and the next bar that is below 10% is showing you that the introduction of both zidovudine and 3-TC as dual therapy for PMTCT reduced the transmission of HIV from a pregnant mother with HIV positive to a child by to less than 10%. And if you look at the triple therapy, you know, including HART, where you include zidovudine, 3-TC, and nevirapine, you could actually reduce the transmission of HIV to less than 5%. So overall, what this is saying is that transmission rates are as high as 35% when there is no intervention, and below 5% when antiretroviral treatment and appropriate care are available. And therefore, we have advocated for the use of PMTCT because of this kind of evidence. And for me, if any intervention is 80% effective, I call it best evidence. And this is why I throw this best evidence for this one. In the next slide, I'm going to talk about these weapons of mass protection, the male condoms and the female condoms. Now, this is not an easy one because people are going to ask you a question. You said you were using evidence that has tested things through randomized controlled trials, where you had one group using the intervention and another group not using the intervention. And in the case of male condoms, we got experience from family planning programs and also from what you call natural experiment. But if you look at the publication at the bottom of the screen. This publication is as old as 2004. It was looking at condom promotion for HIV prevention in the developing world. And the question was, is it working? And it was published in a journal called Studies in Family Planning. And this was part of a UNAIDS commissioned meta-analysis and systematic review. And this analysis and systematic review said that male condom use is 90% effective in preventing HIV transmission. And obviously, as I explained earlier on, this is a combination of various interventions that have been done in the past. So meta-analysis for us is just research on previous research on male condoms. Evidence from family planning programs over many years makes it abundantly clear that the condom is a safe and relatively effective method. And obviously, 90% for me is best evidence. And obviously, many people who have tested it might say that, yeah, it has got all these problems, it bends, it does this, but it's 10% failure rate, but 90% effectiveness rate. Now, with regard to the female condom, now based on laboratory and clinical evidence, the United States Food and Drug Administration approves the female condom as 94 to 97% effective in reducing the risk of HIV infection if used correctly and consistently. Now, 94 to 97% effective is quite high. And as far as I'm concerned, this is classified as best evidence. In the next slide, I want to spend time on the STI treatment, treatment for sexually transmitted infections. The lights were off in Pretoria for a minute. And people thought something is wrong with the STI. Now, the evidence from cluster randomized control trial in Mwanza in Tanzania suggests that improved STI treatment services were shown to reduce HIV transmission by about 40%. But 40% was not something that was satisfactory to the researchers, and they conducted other clinical trials. Two trials were conducted, and they indicated that there is no evidence for substantial benefit from STI treatment of all community members. So this is not encouraging. It's 40% in one trial, but two other trials that were conducted, they did not see any decline in the prevalence of HIV or the transmission of HIV through treatment of people who have a sexually transmitted infection. Now, Cochrane reviewers concluded that limited evidence from randomized control trials indicates that STI control serves as an effective HIV prevention strategy. Now, for me, 40% will be classified as promising. And when they say no evidence, it means no evidence, and therefore this is just one area where you have promising evidence in one trial, but three trials are showing no evidence. And obviously where the systematic reviewers or Cochrane reviewers are saying there's limited evidence, I provided the word promising evidence for the case. And therefore, we cannot, if we have a lot of money, quickly run to an intervention like this one, because the evidence is not conclusive, and even if we have the evidence, it is just promising. Let me talk about microbicides and cervical barriers. And there are several interventions that are going on. I'm only going to report about those that have been published. And studies of early generation microbicides have failed to detect a prevention benefit, and disappointing results were reported on the HIV prevention potential for female diaphragms. Now, a study called HPTN-035, which is a multi-center clinical trial conducted at 7 sites, 6 of these sites are in Africa. This intervention evaluated the safety and effectiveness of two candidate microbicides. These are BufaGel and PRO 2000 with 3,099 participants. I know many of you saw the results of this study early this year or late last year. PRO 2000 was 30% effective compared with no gel, but BufaGel had no detectable effect on preventing HIV infection. So when it comes to BufaGel, we say no evidence. pro 2000, the evidence shows only 30%. When it comes to topical microbicides, the researchers are saying they have not performed well in human HIV prevention studies, with 10 trials of surfactant and polyionic compounds yielding negative results. The negative results means instead of them providing protection for people who are using them, they actually put them at risk. They become, those that are in the intervention group have got a higher chance of getting infected than those that are in the control group. And therefore, one could say, with regard to early generation microbicides and female diaphragms, no evidence. With regard to topical microbicides, it's not just no evidence, it's also negative results, because in some cases, some studies had to be stopped and people have to be withdrawn from those studies. But the finding that the Pro 2000 was 30% effective provides some promise. And so I have graded it as promising evidence specifically for Pro 2000. In the next slide, and this is the last slide for biomedical interventions, HIV vaccine. Everybody's asking the question, when are we getting the vaccine? I will repeat what the clinical scientists are saying. We are a long way off. We're still far. Last year they said 7 to 10 years. And I don't know what they're saying now. But here is the latest information. If you look at the bottom of the screen, the publication in the New England Journal of Medicine of the 20th of October 2009 was about a study on vaccination with AlphaVac and AIDSvax to prevent HIV-1 infection in Thailand. This was a study that was done among the soldiers in Thailand. Now, the Thai phase 3 HIV vaccine clinical trial, also called RV144, tested the prime boost combination of two vaccines, called AlphaVac HIV vaccine, which is called the prime, and AlphaVac BNE vaccine, also called the boost. Now, the vaccine combination was based on HIV strains that commonly circulate in Thailand. And just to let you know that it's not the same type of strain that we have in Southern Africa or in this part of the world. Now, the trial demonstrated that the vaccine regimen was safe and modestly effective in preventing HIV infection. The results show that the prime boost combination lowered the rate of HIV infection by 31.2%. And this is the excitement that came up a little bit last month when the results came out of Thailand from the US researchers and the Thai researchers. Now, the HIV Vaccine Trials Network, also called HVTN, launched the first large-scale study to evaluate a candidate clade B HIV vaccine. The phase 2B, or test of concept efficacy trial, involved 3,000 participants at 5 sites in South Africa. Now, unfortunately, the trials were halted in September 2007 owing to the vaccine's lack of efficacy. There were problems as they were testing the concept of whether, you know, you can introduce a vaccine into a human being and that will generate, you know, the production of antibodies so that the body can fight for against HIV infection if it were introduced in some other form. Now, what we can say before we leave this slide, 31.2% in my grading says this is promising evidence. Okay. In the past, we never had any news that was coming anywhere near this on a HIV vaccine trial. But with regard to the HIV vaccine trials network that included the HIV vaccine test in South Africa, no evidence at this point in time. But I think they are continuing with the study. We might hear if they are getting anything closer to what the Thai study found. Here is a summary. If you were asleep in Cape Town, Durban, or Pretoria, I have kindly made a summary for you on all the things that I've been talking about in the last 15 to 20 minutes. We said male condoms are effective 90%. And therefore, we classify them as best evidence. Female condoms, according to the Food and Drug Administration in the U.S., they are 94 to 97%. We say it's best evidence. PMTCT, which is now including dual therapy and triple therapy, is 92 to 98% through randomized controlled trials. We say these three interventions are best evidence according to my grade. But the highly active antiretroviral drugs are 60 to 80% effective through randomized controlled trials, and we say they are good evidence. Male circumcision is 65% effective according to the systematic reviews that were conducted by the Cochrane group, and we say they are part of what we call good evidence. But when it comes to microbicides, HPT N035 showed us that PRO2000 is only 30% effective, and therefore it is a promising evidence. STI treatment in one of the studies was 40% effective in one of the randomized control trials. So we can just take that one as a promising evidence. But we just said now that the RV144 Thai vaccine trial was 31.2% effective in reducing HIV transmission, and therefore we also classify it as promising evidence. We do not have evidence. In fact, there may be a negative aspects with regard to HIV vaccine trial networks where there's no efficacy in randomized controlled trials. And the early generation microbicides and topical microbicides, we have not, they have failed in randomized controlled trials. About 10 randomized controlled trials have been conducted in this area, and we've not had any success. I hope this summary helps you. You can go back to sleep. You'll come back when we give the summary on behavioral and structural intervention. Now, with regard to behavioral and HIV prevention interventions, there have been questions about whether behaviors or behavior change works. Let's look at abstinence-only interventions and what we call ABC interventions. I also want us to look at the VCT, and I also want us to look at stepping stones counseling intervention, and also look at what we call multiple concurrent partnerships, whether there's evidence in any of these three. But while we start with the behavioral HIV prevention interventions, I just want to refer you to a publication that came out last year at the Mexico conference, at the International AIDS conference in Mexico City. This publication was prepared by a group of scientists. This is called the Behavior Change HIV Prevention. It's a working group, and the title of this is Behavior Change in HIV Prevention, Reconsiderations for the 21st Century. Now, Helen Dale was the co-chair of the Global HIV Prevention Working Group in 2008. And she said something interesting. She said, and I quote her, "Behavioral HIV prevention works. Some have been pessimistic that it's possible to reduce HIV risk behaviors on a large scale, but this concern is misplaced." I close the quote. Now, remember when I was doing the grading of the pyramid on evidence that opinions come down the line? Here is an opinion, okay, of a person who participated in the Global HIV Prevention Working Group. And I think we need to test whether this opinion, you know, holds water when we put in the evidence on the table. Let's talk about abstinence-only interventions. I know there are many of you who come from NGOs that are propagating abstinence-only interventions. A Cochrane review of 13 randomized control trials comparing abstinence-only programs to various control groups in the U.S. concluded that abstinence-only programs do not appear to reduce or exacerbate HIV risk among participants in high-income countries, although this evidence might not apply beyond the U.S. youth. Now, of the 13 trials, 7 trials reported incidence of vaginal sex. So in the trials where they were putting in individuals on a program called abstinence only, and young people would make a commitment that they would not have sex, but in 7 of the 13 trials, there was evidence that the young people had been involved in sex. So it actually tells you that no evidence. In fact, part of the conclusion is saying that abstinence-only interventions are not only showing no evidence, but they may be dangerous in some places because it gives false sense of security to young people who go on and become pregnant or even engage in risky sex. Now, just something. Nothing has been done directly about ABC, and I know many of you have read stuff from Uganda about the where they attribute the success of Uganda's HIV the decline in the prevalence of HIV/AIDS in Uganda to the ABC. Now, a publication also coming out last year, 2008, there was a special edition in which they were focusing on behavioral interventions. And Collins et al. Said something about ABC. Again, I think because we did not have enough randomized controlled trials and systematic reviews specifically on behavioral interventions and particularly on ABC. I want to quote them here, and Collins and colleagues are saying, it is time to scrap the ABCs and elevate the debate on HIV prevention beyond the incessant controversies over individual interventions. Small-scale, isolated HIV prevention programs, however effective, will not bring the AIDS epidemic under control. Policymakers, donors, and advocates need to demand national prevention efforts. ABC infantilizes prevention, oversimplifying what should be an ongoing strategic approach to reducing incidence. In short, they are trashing ABC. They say, you cannot waste time on this. You can do something else rather than concentrating on abstinence, be faithful, and condomize. This is an opinion, and I think sometime we need to look at whether this opinion. Until such time somebody conducts, you know, a randomized controlled trial and or later a systematic review on ABC, we would not be able to have the evidence. But as far as abstinence-only intervention, it is quite clear that there is no evidence. And therefore, I say this is an opinion. It is not something that we can say there's evidence about it. So this person is saying, don't even use ABC. HIV counseling and testing. I'm referring here to a publication that was done in 2005. And this publication was a meta-analysis of 11 studies of the impact of counseling and testing for people living with HIV/AIDS. They were comparing people who live with HIV/AIDS and people who do not know their HIV status. And this study found that there was 68% reduction in high-risk sexual behaviors with partners not already HIV positive. And there were very similar findings for men and women. Now, examining a pool of 27 studies, another meta-analysis found no significant impact of counseling and testing bundle on behavior relative to those that are untested for HIV. Now, a 68% reduction in high-risk sexual behavior, I classify that as good evidence. But this is specifically for those who know that they are HIV positive. If they were tested, they know about their HIV status, they are more likely not to transmit their infection to others. And this actually is related to the positive prevention studies, obviously. But here, this other study is indicating that there is no evidence found in 27 other studies. And this is for people who are not necessarily sure about their HIV status at this point in time. I think there are other studies, and I think many of you know that there is a study conducted by our colleagues in Sweetwater, Devon, the CYFSD, and we are waiting for the findings of the study. It's a community randomized controlled trial, and as soon as they have a publication, we will be able to share that information. And so for us, any research that is being done in communities, particularly following randomized controlled trials, we await the findings so that we can be able to know whether the intervention works or does not work. Let me share about Stepping Stones. It's an HIV counseling intervention. And the aim of this study was conducted by colleagues from the Medical Research Council, Rachel Dukes and colleagues. They conducted a cluster randomized controlled trial in 70 villages in the Eastern Cape. 35 villages were randomized, you know, to receive the intervention, and 35 villages were to serve as controls to get standard treatment or no treatment. In fact, it was standard treatment for the state. Now, this is a 50-hour participatory learning counseling program, and what it did was it did a few things. The main outcome measure was to see if they introduced an intervention, whether it will lower the prevalence or incidence of HIV/AIDS. That was never achieved, to summarize the findings. But several other things were achieved. This includes the intervention lowered the risk of herpes simplex virus type 2, what we call HSV2 infection, by 34.9 per 1,000 people that were exposed in the community. Now, compared with the shorter program, stepping stones did not lower the incidence of HIV-1 infection and had a variable impact on risk behavior in the young adults that were studied. Now, men who completed the stepping stones program over a period of time that was prescribed reported less intimate partner violence, this is encouraging, over 2 years, less transactional sex over 12 months, and less problem drinking over 12 months. This is not the main outcome measure that they wanted in the study, but at least they got something, you know, smaller. And stepping stones, however, stepping stones women reported more transactional sex than women in the control group. This was disappointing for this particular study, because you put people in a study, in an intervention, in so many villages, and instead of reducing transactional sex, those that are in the intervention, they do more transactional sex than those that are in the control group. Fair, eh? So no evidence on lowering HIV incidence, and no, and in fact negative, you know, with regard to transactional sex among women. But promising evidence, you know, that this study cost a lot of money in so many villages and in an interesting part of the world, you know, the rural areas of South Africa. There was promise that there was less intimate partner violence among men over a two-year period, but also the lowering the risk of herpes simplex type 2 was encouraging in this particular study. Now, multiple concurrent partnerships. I just want to share two articles that appear at the bottom of your screen. Ma and Halperin submitted a paper to AIDS and Behavior in 2008. In this paper, it was titled Concurrent Sexual Partnerships and the HIV Epidemics in Africa. Evidence to move forward. And they were providing evidence that you know, the HIV epidemic in many African countries was associated with their multiple concurrent partnerships. And their paper, you know, was read extensively, and many of us started, you know, basing our interventions on that paper to say that their multiple concurrent partnerships are the driver of the HIV epidemic. However, in 2009, about a few weeks ago, Lurie and Rosenthal, you know, challenged the evidence that was presented by Ma and Halperin in a paper titled Concurrent Partnerships as a Driver of the HIV Epidemic in Sub-Saharan Africa, The Evidence is Limited. And this was published a few weeks ago. And from there, this is what their conclusions are saying. They say, taken together, the evidence that concurrency is driving the Africa AIDS epidemic is limited. There is as yet no conclusive evidence that concurrency, one, is associated with HIV prevalence, or two, increases the size of an HIV epidemic, three, increases the speed of HIV transmission, or four, increases the persistence of HIV in a population, or five, that this relationship has a large magnitude of effect. Now, what is interesting about this fight between the two set of scientists was that the current data on multiple concurrent partnerships comes from cross-sectional and ecological studies only. There was no randomized controlled trial in this area or no observational studies. Therefore, that is why I have chosen to take the sides with Lurie and Rosenthal, because there was no randomized controlled trial on which Ma and Halperin based their evidence. And therefore, there is no evidence at this point in time. And this is my own gradation. This is how I grade the evidence on the basis of what I see. We can have a big debate later on. Let me jump to structural HIV prevention interventions. And just one structural HIV prevention intervention was conducted in rural Limpopo. And this was a study that was done by Paul Cronick, Jimmy Hargreaves, Julia Kim, and colleagues. They were looking at the effect of a structural intervention for the prevention of intimate partner violence and HIV in rural South Africa. They conducted a cluster randomized controlled trial that was published in The Lancet, I think it was in 2006. Now, this is called the IMAGE study on microfinance. And IMAGE is an abbreviation for Intervention with Microfinance for AIDS and Gender Equity. Now, this randomized controlled trial in rural Limpopo assessed a structural intervention that combined a microfinance program with a gender and HIV training curriculum. The study found that experience of intimate partner violence was reduced by 55%. Now, the intervention did not affect the rate of unprotected sex with a non-spousal partner, and there was no effect on the rate of unprotected sex at last occurrence with a non-spousal partner, or did they reduce HIV incidence in cohort 3. Now, to summarize this, it says no effect on the rate of unprotected sex and no effect on HIV incidence, which means the study did not achieve the main outcome measure that we're interested in of reducing HIV incidence among women who participated in the study. But the fact that there was a reduction of 55% in intimate partner violence means that we have a promise here that even if you put women together, you give them money, and you provide them with some other kind of HIV training, and then there is a reduction in intimate partner violence, there is promise here, and I think there is a need to follow up. You may challenge, you know, what happened in this study, but what's important is there is a promise that can be followed up for the future. Let me summarize for those who were asleep, or adults do not sleep, they think with their eyes closed, or they pray for good answers or for good evidence. So if you were thinking with your eyes closed, here's a summary for you. With regard to behavioral and structural HIV prevention interventions, none of them had what I call best evidence. None. But one, HIV counseling and testing for people living with HIV/AIDS showed 58% reduction in high-risk sexual behavior in one community randomized controlled trial. And therefore, we only have one behavioral and or structural prevention intervention that shows good evidence. With regard to promising evidence, some aspects of stepping stones and some aspects of the IMAGE study showed some promising evidence, although these were not the main outcome measures. Stepping stones lower the risk of herpes simplex 2 virus and also reduced intimate partner violence and less transsexual sex. IMAGE study, intimate partner violence was reduced by 55%, and this is what we found. The interventions that do not have any evidence with regard to behaviors and structure are abstinence-only interventions, clear from the randomized control trials and or the systematic reviews conducted in the US. HCT on untested people, no impact of counseling and testing on behavior of untested, and the stepping stones did not lower the incidence of HIV-1, and the IMAGE study had no effect on HIV incidence, and the concurrency, I did make an argument that there is no conclusive evidence that multiple concurrent partnerships are the drivers of the epidemic. Let me come to a conclusion. For some of you, the AIDS epidemic has taught us to be innovative. You can realize that we were innovative with developing drugs, with developing all sorts of things. We were inventive. We tested and implemented many new interventions. We now have evidence of HIV prevention strategies that work. I have classified them according to best evidence and good evidence. We are more like a zebra on a bike. This is really innovative. If you see a zebra on a bike, how does it hold, you know? And how does it go into the brakes, you know? This is innovative. The HIV epidemic taught us a lot of things in the 28 years. We're innovative. However, I will dampen your spirit by saying that despite all these innovations and all these microbicides, the ARVs, the circumcisions, the counseling and testing, and the compelling evidence of effective strategies that we talked about today, the killer virus is still chasing us and killing us. And I will dampen your spirits again to say the statistics that will come out will still show that 33 million people are infected with HIV, 25 million people have died, and we are arguing now whether in South Africa is 600,000 or 700,000 people who die per year of AIDS-related diseases. Besides all this evidence, it is discouraging. It is more like having all that zebra on a bike being chased by a lion and get killed. After all the money that we have spent, after all the effort, and all the intelligence that we have of doing the vaccine and all sorts of things. But however, this is my last slide, in case you wanted to sleep. And the take-home message from me is that there is no magic bullet for HIV. If you came into this presentation and were hoping that I was going to present about the magic bullet or about the cure, I'm sorry. I apologize. We do not have a cure for now. We do not have a magic bullet. And I quote from the Global HIV Prevention Working Group. And they say, it is critical to note that there is no magic bullet for HIV prevention. None of the new prevention methods currently being tested is likely to be 100% effective, and all will need to be used in combination with existing prevention approaches if they are to reduce the global burden of HIV/AIDS. The key word there is combination prevention. This is the take-home message for you. No magic bullet, but because we know of certain things that are best evidence and good evidence, if we combine some of those best evidence and good evidence interventions, we are able to move forward and deal with the epidemic. I thank you.
I think you must agree with me that it doesn't look very good. Myself, I thought I would pick up one and say, this one I'm going to preach to everyone that it works, and I'm going to practice. But often, most of models don't work, but some are more useful than others. At least there is hope. When Jeff was giving his conclusion, I said, wow, we are more confused than we were before. But I think there is some hope. If you combine one, two, it's better than having one that does not work. And it's better than concentrating your efforts on what has already been proved not to work. But over and above that, I know we have many questions, because some of our evidences, some of our models have been trashed, and we are wondering, what have I been doing for all these years? So I want to for us to be able to thank Jeff, give a clap for Jeff, it was a great presentation. But we shouldn't leave him like that. If he has trashed your model that you have worked in for so long, you have a right to question him. You've got a right to ask questions. We've got three offices. We have Pretoria, we have Cape Town, and we have Durban. I would want us to take 5 questions in each center, then Jeff can report to them, and then we proceed and move to the other section. So if you have a question, just shoot up.
I'm not worried, Dr. Sister, that your